UK Wine Show number 25 for the 17th of November. Oz Clark. G'day, and welcome to the UK Wine Show number 25 for the 17th of November. This week we're going to be interviewing Oz Clark. Oz is the Wine Communicator of the Year. He's been the Wine Communicator of the Year for the last couple of years now. And we're going to be finding out a bit about Oz, how he got into the wine scene, and what a girl dressed in green has to do with wine. We'll also be talking to Oz about his new TV show, Oz and James' Big Adventure, with Top Gear's James May, as they cruise around France in an old Jag. The show's going to be coming out on the 22nd of November. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Up until now, New Zealand wine has been best known for Sauvignon Blanc, but Pinot Gris looks set to take the world by storm. Production of this grape variety in New Zealand is up 122% on last year, and although it remains small fry compared to the volumes of Sauvignon Blanc, it comes top of the growth league table for varieties planted. Increased planting in New Zealand has meant a new record this year for the country's wine industry, with the vintage coming in at 184,000 tonnes. This increased volume, however, has led to a decrease in the average UK bottle price of New Zealand wine, from £6 last year to £5.92. That said, it's still the highest average price of any country. Surprisingly, Australia comes second highest, but only at £4.30 a bottle. Warren Adamson of New Zealand Wine Growers explained that higher volumes are being sold in the UK across all the price points, and as a generic country, New Zealand is not immune to price promotions. He remains confident, though, that New Zealand wines will remain as premium as they always have been. Meanwhile, with the Asian wine market growing by leaps and bounds, the rest of the wine world is looking for a slice of the action. Last week, Korea hosted the Wine for Asia exhibition, a platform to present wine from around the world to the Asian market. It attracted some big names in the industry, such as the owner of Chateau Margaux in Bordeaux, and Michel Roland, one of the world's most influential wine consultants. In fact, Michel chose Korea to debut the Roland collection. These are wines that he's produced himself, rather than ones he's just been a consultant for. He told us, "Korean people are very nice, they like wine. It seems to me their culture is more French than any other country in the world. And it's a market with bags of potential, especially as the Koreans are switching from spirits to wine because of the perceived health benefits." In the first half of this year, wine imports to Korea were up over 22%, according to the Global Agricultural Information Network. And finally this week, The Independent on Sunday has scrapped its drinks column, which was written by Richard Ehrlich for almost a decade. Tim Lewis, editor of The Independent on Sunday's Sunday Review, told us that Richard had written a wonderful drinks column for the Sunday Review for many years, but as part of an overhaul of the living section, he had written his final column for the magazine. No decision has been made about drinks coverage in the future. That's all in the news this week. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks for that, Jane. I suppose the thing about the Pinot Gris, you know, out of New Zealand is a wee bit of a surprise. A couple of years ago, a lot of people were talking about Viognier being pretty important. And Pinot Gris, to me, doesn't always have necessarily the same punchiness or impact that a Sauvignon Blanc has. So it may be harder for them to maintain good pricing for it. One of the good things about Pinot Gris in New Zealand is it does have a nice mouth textural feel. It's a real textural wine as opposed to that real punchy Sauvignon Blanc you get all in the nose, whereas Pinot Gris is very mouthfeel orientated. And it makes it a much easier food wine as well. Next, we're going to have the interview with Oz Clark.
Hi, I'm here with Oz Clark, Wine Personality of the Year. How are you, Oz?
Well, not as lively as you are. What is all this bright hilarity? You're supposed to be feeling hungover and ill and full of alcohol, but you're not, are you?
Four cups of coffee, it's pretty good.
Kiwis, you can't keep them down.
How long have you been in the trade, Oz? You've been in it for ages.
No idea.
No idea.
Can't remember. I don't look back. I just look forward. I'm a carpe diem kind of guy. Seize the day. Get on with it.
Yeah.
People ask me questions like that, and I think they're like, you know, how long you lived in your house? I think, I don't know. How long you owned your car? I don't know. How long you had a girlfriend? Well, she'd know.
Yeah.
But I've just been hanging around it since I was a student. You know, I was an actor.
Yep.
Then I was a singer. I was hoping to be a bishop, but I discovered that the career path was a bit erratic.
Yeah.
So then I just fell into it, you know, woke up in a gutter one morning and thought, that was fun, I'll do that again. Yeah. And then someone started paying me.
Really? Oh, that's brilliant. Do you remember your first glass of wine, or is that so long ago?
Oh, no, remember it very well. I was 3 years old.
Really?
And it was my mother's damson wine. It was absolutely smashing. Every single time I find a wine now which tastes of damsons, I give it 20 out of 20 straight away.
Really?
any new Argentine Malbec that wants 20 out of 20, make it taste of damsons, I'll give you 20 out of 20.
Fantastic.
We were having a picnic on the River Ouse near Cambridge. My dad was finishing off his doctorate there. And my brother was drowning in the river.
And you're sipping wine.
Well, my mother was having hysterics. My father was dived in to try and save my brother. So I just saw this bottle of wine by the side of the on the grass by the side of the picnic. So I drank it.
Yeah, and you liked it?
I loved it.
Yeah.
My brother did survive, by the way. I very nearly didn't. He did survive. But he put me off alcohol for hours.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was well into nearly 3.5 before I tried it again.
I must admit, we let our little girl smell a lot of wine. We don't let her drink too much.
No, I wouldn't. But a tiny sip here and there is not a bad idea. Yeah, but exactly. I think the point is, if she likes flavours, they're so good at flavours, kids.
Yeah.
So it's a pity not to let them know that the wine world's a fantastic world. And it's not threatening, and you don't have to be too up yourself about it. But they have to be aware that it's alcohol, and alcohol is not something that you want kids to find easy. I mean, the real problem with alcohol pops and things at the moment is it's too easy. I remember when trying to get into alcohol, you know, hey, I was 16 or 17. I wasn't 10 or something, which I really get upset when I see kids drinking at that young age. Like kids of 10 or 11 smoking, you think, what? How can we stop you? How can we stop you doing this to yourself? Because it's going to all end in tears and misery if you're not careful. Exactly. But, I mean, I think that kids' palates are so sharp and so smart, and they are so easy to say the first thing that comes into their mind. And they also, sometimes they want to impress you by being clever and all this kind of thing. And they come up with some wild, wonderful ideas. But I didn't get into real wine until I went to university, because we didn't really drink it at home at all.
Were you one of those wine club people in the university wine?
That's right. I went to Oxford, and Charles Metcalf, the lovely Charles Metcalf, who I know you know, tip-top guy, he introduced me to wine up at Oxford, and we you know, I remember my first wine tasting. I took a girl called Francesca, nice girl.
To impress her?
Yeah, and she was green from head to foot. She had green hair, green sequins on her face, very, very skimpy green top, a green leather skirt, which was just about non-existent, and the rest of her body, which was most of it, was covered in green paint. And I turned up, I thought, this is wonderful, we're going to a wine tasting, a Bordeaux wine tasting. I put my best T-shirt on, my best jeans on, opened the door into this wine tasting. Everyone else was in a pinstripe suit.
Really?
And there was me and this green girl. We sat at the back. But I still remember the flavour of Chateau Léoville Barton 1962.
Yeah.
The flavour of dry black currants and cedar wood and brilliantly clear pebbles and cigar box scent. I just thought, God, if that's what Bordeaux is like, I'm on for that.
Yeah.
And even to this day, if you said, what is your perfect Bordeaux, it would be something like Léoville Barton 62, Langoa Barton 53, Obaye 55, that sort of world of Bordeaux. I don't want the great big bruisers, really. And of course, with global warming and American influence and all the rest, you get more and more big bruisers and less wines like that. But Léoville Barton is probably one of the ones that still does it.
You guys, you're the voice of Chile now, aren't you? Or you're one of their PR people, is that?
No. I'm not anyone's PR person, but I like the Chileans. Right? They're a good bunch. Anita is a top girl. Michael Cox is a top guy. And when he asked me to do your wine tasting for him, I do. I mean, yep. I've just done one from France.
Yeah.
Did some for Beaujolais recently. Can't give them a kick.
I saw the Beaujolais one at the wine show.
Ah, good. Yeah. I'm doing some Rioja tastings. You know, we're freelancers, and you know, as long as you believe in the product, I'm perfectly happy to you know, learn up about it, get some wines together and do a tasting.
Yeah, excellent. What's your favourite region or wines of the world? Where are you? Now, you're obviously a Bordeaux man of some sorts.
I'm a Bordeaux man of some sort. I like France enormously. I like Bordeaux. It's not the friendliest place. It's not the prettiest place. The wines are not the easiest. But something keeps drawing me back, probably because I started there.
Yeah.
But if I said, you know, where am I happiest, I would say places like New Zealand. I love going to New Zealand. I don't get there nearly often enough, of course. And it's not just because you're tall and handsome and sort of violent. It's because...
Big and bald.
Yeah, that's what I meant by tall and handsome. I sympathise. But I love going to New Zealand. I don't get there as often as I'd like to. It's a long way away. I really enjoy going to Australia. And I enjoy going to Australia and stepping off that plane and straight away from the corporates, you know. As soon as I can get away, I don't want to go and see the big companies. And with the exception of someone like Phil Laffer at Jacobs Creek, he's a top guy.
Yeah.
But I just don't want that world. The real world of Australia, I want to get back to. The men and women really passionate about what they do. It's the same with the small winery world in New Zealand. It's just the same.
Nice
I love going over the Andes. I think there's so much still to find out and do in Chile and Argentina. Chile, I think, is ahead of Argentina at the moment. Funny, some of the wine buffs say, Argentina's ahead of Chile. I don't agree. I think Argentina's got a lot to do before it catches up with Chile. And the nice thing about Chile is it's really thought about, we need to give people a wider spread of choice, and it's in terms of grape varieties and in terms of places. There's now, I think, 750 miles north to south of vineyards in Chile. Now, you can get a lot of different styles in 750 miles.
I've heard the Sauvignon Blancs coming out of Chile are starting to
getting better and better. Yes, they are. The point is they're about £1.50 a bottle cheaper. From Casablanca and later San Antonio, maybe Biobío further south. I mean, they're very cool climate. They haven't quite got the real bite of a good Marlborough New Zealand Sauvignon, but they're a very good new addition to the marketplace, just like the stuff from the west coast of South Africa.
Yeah.
Stuff from Durbanville Hills and Darling in South Africa. Now, that also rivals New Zealand. Different style again, a bit more austere, a bit more haughty, which you sort of expect from the South Africans. But good stuff, West Coast Sauvignons, smashing stuff. The world, I mean, New Zealand has taught the world how Sauvignon can be, and everyone's trying to do it now.
You've just done a TV series, haven't you? Cruising around France.
With James May from Top Gear.
Yeah, how was that?
I said, hey, James, how do you describe yourself? He said, I describe myself as the other bloke on Top Gear.
He's the sort of tall, big guy with the curly hair.
He's a top guy.
Yeah,
he's a top guy, yeah. And basically, he has to play the sort of wine hooligan and the lout, but he's not a lout at all. He's a really interesting, complex, amusing, artistic fellow. I mean, you know, he studied harpsichord at university.
Oh, really?
And he can spout 19th century English poetry by the yard. He knows all 41 verses of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Right. He knows all 41 verses. You can't stop. Once he gets going, off he goes. You can see his look come into his eyes, and he starts going, and then quoth he at the tavern door, off he goes. No, top
was
guy.
It good fun? How long
good
were you?
Fun.
How long were you?
About 4 or 5 weeks.
Four or 5 weeks filming and cruising around.
But working. You work 15, 16 hours a day on those things.
Yeah,
You have to get the dawn light, you have to get the dusk light, and you have to get the after-hour shots, all of that stuff. And eventually, one of the things that we realized was the curse of the French lunch. After a week, I had to say to the director, "We've got to stop having these lunches. We can't have lunch because the French take it too seriously. So it's much better if we just don't have it at all." Because I said every single shot that we do, I bet the least successful one each day has been the one after lunch. He said, "Absolutely right." I said, "We've got to stop it."
Really?
No lunch. So really,
is it the food or the wine that you have with the food?
We didn't know. Well, we didn't. I had no wine unless it was part of the shoot.
Yeah.
James had no wine at all if he was driving, and if I was driving, I couldn't. You and I know we can taste and spit and not drink anything. But for the television audience, don't necessarily know that. So we just basically made a rule that if one or other of us would be doing the spitting, and James would be pouring it down his throat, and we made it very clear in each episode, if that was James pouring it down his throat, I had the car keys in my hand, so that nobody could even think that we were drinking and driving. We breathalyzed ourselves a few times, and I always scored naught.
Oh, that's good.
Absolute zero. And I think that, he scored naught when he had the keys in his hand, he hadn't had any wine at all, because he said, "I don't know about this spitting business, so I better have none at all." But he's a good wine drinker. And when he's had about 5 or 6 glasses of wine, he's passionate and philosophical and poetic and excited about the whole thing. He could be a tip-top wine guy. And in fact, he said, "You bastard," excuse my language. He said, "You've ruined me," he said. "You've ruined me." Because, of course, I gave him. He said, "You and your posh friends have given me all this smart wine. And now I'm ruined. I can't go back to my $2.99 from Asda."
I read some stuff that he was more of a beer man.
He's a big beer man. He loves beer. I love beer too. So we go out into the pub. Well, we haven't been able to at the end of the year with Richard Hammond's accident. We sort of had to avoid the pub and things to make sure that we were not wandering around saying, hey, here's a, have a nice pint of beer together when Richard was in danger.
Yeah, sure.
But once Richard was out of danger, obviously, you know, we meet in pubs normally and have a couple of good pints of beer. But he's a beer man, and he knows his beer, and he likes good beer. Likes good pies, likes good sausages, likes good beans, likes good fish and chips. He's got a very fundamental approach to food and drink. And now I've ruined him because he also likes Chateau Pichon Baron, £100 a bottle, and Chateau Lalande and Chateau Lever Lascars and top Burgundies and wonderful Cote de Rhones and Hermitages at £150 a bottle. He likes them all, and it's my fault.
Excellent. Well, wrap it up there, Oz. Thank you, mate, very much for your time.
Lovely to see you again.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Oz. He's quite a character and a fabulous guy to talk to. Next week, we're going to be talking to Simon Waghorn. Simon is the winemaker at Whitehaven, and he's also the winemaker at Astrolabe. They're both wines from Marlborough, New Zealand, and Simon's Astrolabe was voted the International Wine Spirit Competition's trophy winner for Sauvignon Blanc. He's a winemaker I've known for a couple of years now, and he's a top bloke, knows quite a bit about wine, and he makes some of the best savvies out of New Zealand. So until then, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff de Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.